Appeals, in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this Honorable Court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Graves.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Mr. Glickman, ladies and gentlemen, before the Court. I'm Lauren Comstock, the appellant attorney for Curtis Graves. This case is before the Court on a criminal appeal following Mr. Graves' verdicts of guilty in the Southern District of Indiana, Indianapolis Division, and as to allegations of distribution of crack cocaine in the excess of 50 grams. The trial in this matter was held on February 2nd, 2003, and February 3rd, 2003, and Judge Hambleton sentenced the defendant appellant here on September 28, 2004, to a term of 30 years, of which 10 years of that sentence was as a career criminal. The defendant is currently incarcerated in the McCreary Penitentiary in Kentucky. I want to cut right to the core of my argument and what I think the heart of the appeal is here, waiving none of my prior arguments made in the two briefs filed with the Court. At first, I believe the critical argument here, the critical issue, was the effectiveness of Mr. Graves' trial counsel vis-a-vis the ineffectiveness issue. The biggest
is
thing...
Is there some reason, counsel, why you want to argue ineffective assistance on direct appeal? The basic problem with doing that is that the record, obviously, is not complete. And because the record is not complete, it isn't possible to evaluate the reasons why counsel did what he did and prejudice, if any, so that as a practical matter, you have no chance of success. And why not withhold this until collateral review?
That's a good suggestion, Your Honor, and I take it, and I only made the initial statement on advice of my client. But I agree with you totally on that position. And I will withhold it and withdraw it at this point.
The ineffective assistance claim is withdrawn.
All right. Going to the next issue, which I want to broach to the Court, goes to the sentencing of the defendant, Your Honor. Since I filed my original brief, the United States Supreme Court came down with the Shepherd decision, which I included in my reply brief. Now, the problems that I see brought about with Shepherd, combined with Booker and the other things, is whether Mr. Graves' sentencing was appropriate given the instructions which I think Judge Souter sets forth in the Shepherd decision, which came down after my original break.
Shepherd decision involved what documents could be relied on to show the nature of the prior conviction, right?
Well, that's part of it, Judge, but I think...
But here that you're not relying on any documents. This is a finding by the judge as to whether it's in the same course of conduct, isn't it?
Well, but the findings, I think, that he made were not in accord with what Justice Souter said should be looked at in this situation. And going specifically to any explicit fact...
What facts did he rely on other than the face of the documents from state court?
None that I know of. I can't tell from looking
That's the holding of Shepard, that the federal judge can look at the face of the documents from state court and nothing else. And if he relied here on nothing else, what's the problem?
Well, I think Shepard has a broader approach, Your Honor. It is instructing the trial courts at sentencing to look at several things. Explicit findings of facts by the trial judge, which I find nothing was done in this regard when looking at the sentencing transcript, transcripts of the plea, written plea agreements. I think Shepard goes beyond saying what the trial court cannot do as opposed to what they should do in this respect. And I find that the trial judge did nothing whatsoever in this regard in sentencing Mr. Graves.
That's certainly an unusual understanding of Booker and Shepard, that the trial judge has to take a greater role. Most people understand them as saying that under the Sixth Amendment, the trial judge has to take a lesser role.
Let me go, if I can, Judge. Certain things at trial were violative of Mr. Graves' Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment rights, which I think go into the Sixth Amendment question, which we don't want to go into totally at this time. As regards the Fifth Amendment allegations, the police conduct in this case is really subject to scrutiny here. The government says that they had an overwhelming case in this case, but they would have had little or nothing in the way of probative evidence had it not been for the testimony of Tona Jones, who was paid a figure of $2,700, as I know, plus not prosecuting him for a dope which they found on him. The government's activities here, the government's conduct in this case, rises to a level which is totally without any appreciation in this case.
The jury knew about all that, didn't they?
I'm sorry?
The jury knew about all that, did they not?
I can't tell what the jury knew, Judge. It doesn't appear that they did. I wasn't the trial counsel in this case. Mr. Graves is changed counsel. It doesn't appear that they knew all about that. Certainly there is some testimony in there as to what they knew about the conduct, but certainly not everything. The position here, Judge, is very simply this. This man was paid for his testimony. This man was given a break by not being prosecuted. The question here is one which very, very simply is this. Was his testimony credible? Was it subject to withstand any criticism on the thing, or was his will foreborn?
No, if you put the question that way, it's completely a jury question. We don't review credibility disputes.
Well, let me go then to the sufficiency of evidence argument which we have raised. In this case, there was nothing here other basically than Jones's testimony to support the conviction. There were audio tapes, which of course were subject to cross-examination and subject to a clarification as to actually who was saying what, but there were no videotapes of the transactions which would support Jones's testimony. There was once again his cooperation and the issue of free will. When Jones, when Graves was arrested, there were no seizures of the defendant with any buy money. There was no effective defense of entrapment. The government, apparently at their brief at page 16, concedes there may be some problems with Jones's testimony as the states or as evidence aside from his testimony, but I find none of any substantive value. And the issues as to defendant's voice on the audio tape. Of course, once again, there was nothing at trial as to motions to suppress anything here. This goes into the Sixth Amendment, or very well could ride into a Sixth Amendment issue. Nothing done in that regard on preliminary motions, either on the Fourth or the Fifth Amendments. I would call the court's attention to their earlier cases in Chiavolo and X. Rel. V. De Robortis, where the violation of another's rights may be a violation of the defendant's rights, which here again we assert that Jones's rights were violated and this carried over and was prejudicial to the defendant. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Comstock. Mr. Quickman.
May it please the court, I'm Barry Glickman. I'm Assistant United States Attorney. I was trial counsel in this case and appellate counsel as well. Just to very briefly respond to some of the arguments made by counsel for Mr. Graves. Starting with the sentencing issue, it is the position of the United States that Judge Hamilton was well within the parameters of Blakely and Booker in determining that Mr. Graves' two prior convictions qualified him to be a career offender. Beg your pardon. The two separate convictions are spelled out. They were committed on different days. Mr. Graves was arrested on different days. He was sentenced on different days by two different judges. And notwithstanding the fact that he was given concurrent sentences, the evidence indicates that they were two separate convictions.
Did Judge Hamilton make findings on those facts?
I believe he did, Your Honor. I believe he found that Mr. Graves did qualify as a career offender because there was no consolidation and that those two prior convictions counted separately under the guidelines, and therefore he met the criteria for a career offender, having been convicted of two prior violent felonies prior to being convicted for the controlled.
Was it argued that these two violations were in the same course of conduct, or was that not an argument made here?
It suggested in the brief of Mr. Graves. However, there was no evidence of that.
I mean, was that argument made at the trial, at the sentencing?
I don't remember, Your Honor. I don't remember.
But Judge Hamilton just relied on the documents. Is that the thesis?
Relied on the documents and the judgment and convictions to come to his conclusions that they were two separate crimes, committed 9 months apart with different victims, different circumstances, prosecuted as different cases. The sentencings occurred on different dates, and it was handled by different judges. And based on that, Your Honor, I believe Judge Hamilton was correct in coming to the determination that they did qualify as career offender enhancement eligible convictions. Turning to the defense argument that he was somehow deprived of a fair trial, I'm at a loss to see how Mr. Graves can possibly maintain that what happened to Tona Jones in this case would impact his own Fourth Amendment rights. It seems that in Mr. Graves' reply brief, he relies on the case of U.S. against Jones, a 1960 case, which was overturned some 25 years ago by Salvucci and Rawlings and that line of cases. The law in this area is well settled, and Mr. Graves had no basis to file a motion to suppress alleging police conduct with Mr. Jones that happened in September of 2001, well before police contact with him in this case. But that notwithstanding, the evidence in this case was overwhelming. The jury heard about two controlled purchases of crack cocaine from Mr. Graves made in conjunction with Mr. Jones. They heard the audio tapes of those buys. They determined the credibility of Mr. Jones, and we can infer from their jury verdict they came to the conclusion that Mr. Jones was credible and convicted Mr. Graves on both of those counts that he was charged with. And then finally, just turning to something that wasn't argued, but the jury selection of voir dire argument made by the defense in their briefs, I would respectfully suggest to the court that there was nothing at all confusing about jury selection in this case. In the transcript of the voir dire, Judge Hamilton said the following before the jury was selected: if you all would prepare peremptory strikes as to this group in writing, I'll take those. We will seat the 12 jurors with the highest priority seating positions who remain unstruck after this. As to the first group, no back strikes in essence. So once this group clears, they are in. I would respectfully suggest that there was nothing ambiguous about that. Both sides were well aware.
Is that a typical jury selection process used in the Southern District of Indiana?
Depends on the judge, Your Honor. Judge Hamilton does it that way. He requires all strikes be done in writing. Judge Barker does it the same way. No, I'm sorry. Judge Barker calls both attorneys up to the bench, and it's done orally, not in writing. It depends on the judge.
And how about two different groups where you divided into A and B groups? Is that a typical process?
Again, it depends on the judge, Your Honor. In this case, Judge Hamilton's courtroom is the smallest courtroom in our district, and there's just not the space.
So you don't have enough for the whole...
to have everybody in there at once, and I don't want to suggest that that was his thinking, but it is the smallest courtroom in the district. Again, the record indicates that all jurors that were selected were agreed to by both sides. They were impartial, and based on that, I am asking this court to affirm the judgments of the district court in this case. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Glickman. Anything further, Mr. Comstock?
Yes, Your Honor, if I might. First of all, on the sentencing, on the issue of concurrency, and on the issue of how the court should look, or I would suggest how they should look on concurrent sentences under the United States federal guidelines, you got several issues here. First of all, are the federal guidelines at this time to be applied? Are they just to be instructive? Or are they out the window as far as this goes? Now, on the concurrency situation, you've got two cases in the same court, basically the same charges, and under the United States sentencing guidelines, certainly the concurrency is one thing that can be considered here. Now, Graves was out on bond on one case when he got picked up on another case, but they were decided by the same attorney in the same court in the plea agreements show that they are to be concurrent time as far as sentencing goes. So I think you have a couple issues on the sentencing here. Also, once again, I would ask the court to look at the broad window, which I think Shepard should be applied here, that the court...
Counsel, let me ask you a different question about sentencing. Are you asking for a Palladino remand?
Yes. I'm asking for a remand, Your Honor, to go back and find the facts.
No.
From...
Do you know what Palladino is?
I do not know. I'm not aware of it.
Then why did you answer yes to my question?
Well, I thought I understood that, remand. Judge. I would ask for a remand.
No. Look, it is perfectly clear that you don't know the answer to my question. Why don't you, no later than next Wednesday, inform the court whether you are seeking a remand under United States against Palladino. You can find it in volume 401 of the Federal Reporter third series.
Very well, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Now, Shepard just concerned the documents upon which the sentencing judge could rely, did it not? Isn't that the essence of Shepard?
Well, Judge,
what kind of documents he can look at, and what documents did he look at here that Shepard forbade him to look at?
Well, Shepard says, I'm sorry, sir, didn't mean to clip you. Shepard says, as I read to begin with, that a later court in determining the character of admitted burglary is generally limited to examining the statutory definition, charging documents, written plea agreements, transcripts, plea colloquy, any factual finding by the trial judge, which I can't find in the record that he did. Now, I think this goes to the issue of whether there was one sentence in the trial court, whether there was two sentences, and this should be looked at, and this should be looked and in fact should be set forth on this, Your Honor. I think a broader view of Shepherd needs to be looked at here.
What was submitted to the Judge Hamilton with regard to the prior convictions?
That I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know. I wasn't a trial attorney.
Well, no, it's not in the record either.
No. I think these things need to be looked at back by the trial court at this time or at some time. And that's one thing that I'm asking this court to do, regardless of what the motion would be under the case. But I'll certainly take the court's advice and make a motion or letter pursuant to your suggestion, Your Honor.
It's not a motion. We want you to tell us what your view is about whether you seek a remand under the terms of Palladino.
All right. I'll do that. Am I instructed once again as to a time period in doing that?
By next Wednesday. It must reach us by next Wednesday.
Very well. Just a couple of things here. I think that'll do it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Comstock. The case is taken under advisement.